Now, it's Lunchtime Live, BBC Radio Cambridge here, and author, poet and much-loved former children's laureate Michael Rosen will be coming to Cambridgeshire on Monday. The man behind such favourites as We're Going on a Bear Hunt and Don't Put Mustard in the Custard will be here to officially launch Heffer's Bookshop's Giving Tree appeal, which is supporting the local charity Romsey Mill, which do such fantastic work looking after disadvantaged families and young people across the county. Well, he'll also be speaking at an event at the Cambridge Union about his new memoir. It's called So They Call You Pisher, and it documents the first years of his life growing up with communist parents in the Jewish East End. Well, I got a bit starstruck and got the title of the book wrong, as you'll hear next few moments when I caught up with him yesterday afternoon. Welcome to Lunchtime Live. My guest this afternoon, author, poet and former children's laureate Michael Rosen. Good afternoon to you, sir.
Afternoon to you, Jeremy.
And we look forward to welcoming you to our shores, but you're no stranger to Cambridgeshire, are you? You've been paying quite a few visits here recently, I believe.
Yes, I've been doing some work with schools for History Works, which is a big group of people, a company, if you like, who work on local history and history projects with TV. And I've been doing local history projects, working with children, getting them to write poems and songs about local history things, like to do with the workhouse or to do with Isaac Newton or to do with the common land and all sorts of interesting things, the railways, the lions outside the Fitzwilliam Museum, all sorts of lovely local stuff, and even Hobson's Choice.
Actually, do you know what? I was involved in a wonderful event. It was a song for Cambridgeshire, and local schools had penned their own lyrics about what they like most about their school and their area, and you had done a little sort of critique, a little videos in between of their stories.
That's right. I watched them on video, seeing what it was that they'd done, and for each one I made a little comment, what I thought, and I was utterly, I don't know, stunned, impressed. It was wonderful work, wonderful.
You are coming to Heffer's Bookshop. I know you're very kindly launching their Christmas Giving Tree appeal, which is going to raise money for the wonderful local charity that is Romsey Mill, that supports young families and disadvantaged youngsters. But you're also here to talk about your memoir, So They Call Me Pisher. Well, I'm glad I've said that correctly, but what is a pisher, Michael?
Right, OK, I'll have to be a little bit clean here. The title's actually So They Call You Pisher, but it's all right.
It can be
so
my apologies. Called
Pisher. No worries. So you've got to imagine a situation. So my dad is, it's me and my dad, and I'm due to go to the swimming gala. Why did I say fishing? Swimming gala. So imagine that I might be going to the swimming gala, but then I've got cold feet. I don't fancy it. And he says, what's the worst that could happen to you? So they call you Pisher. So Pisher is a kind of rude word in a language called Yiddish that some people may know, which is spoken by most Jews in Eastern Europe before the Second World War. And it's based on Germanic language and Slavonic and bits of Hebrew. I can't exactly translate it because it's rude, but it means a nobody, a nothing, a no good, a good for nothing. So what's the worst that could happen to you? They could say you're no good, you're a good for nothing. So my dad used to say it, and it was a kind of protective thing to say, really, because it's a sort of sticks and stones will break my bones, isn't it? Names will never harm you. So it was something my dad would say to kind of boost my confidence. So what's the worst could happen to you? They call you Pisher.
But we're on safe ground here. We won't have offended our Yiddish-speaking listeners.
No, they may even have got a little twinkle in their eyes. They heard something that maybe their grandfathers or even great-grandmothers, whatever, might have said. No, it's not that rude. It's just basically to do with peeing. So it isn't that rude.
Yeah. Okay, I don't think it's a massive stretch.
It won't suddenly cause Radio Cambridgeshire to be receiving vast numbers of letters.
Well, let's talk about your parents because they're the major characters in this book. They say, you know, that when you get older, however much you try your hardest, you end up turning into your parents. It seems almost that never has it been more true than in your case, perhaps, Michael?
I think so, yes, that's right. One way or another, I've ended up sounding like my dad, talking like my dad, saying all sorts of things that he said. I know, it's a bit daft. They were both teachers. My mum was a primary school teacher, my dad was a secondary school teacher, but they began in very, very humble circumstances in London's East End. My dad, having come over when he was two from America, my mum born here, born in the East End, and they met when they were about 15 or 16, and they were communists. A lot of Jews in the East End were communist or sympathetic with it, because they were under a lot of threat. There were people organising fascist groups, Oswald Mosley organising against them, and people who are under threat, they look around for solutions and help. And for my parents, it seemed to be the Communist Party. So that's what it was. And their first date was probably on the streets of the Battle of Cable Street. Not terribly glamorous, but where they used to amuse us by telling us that they ended up on the wrong side of the barricades. Well, when you hear something like that when you're five, you have no idea what they're talking about. What do you mean barricades? What's a barricade? Why is it funny that you were on the wrong side? I didn't get it. But anyway, there you go.
Yeah, just a bit of potted history, because that was a curious situation, wasn't it, where the police turned out in force to protect the fascist demonstrators.
Yes, well, from their argument was that Oswald Mosley had the freedom, the right, to march through the East End of London. But, of course, it's a very loaded thing. He was at the head of a semi-militarised group, the British Union of Fascists. And why did he choose London's East End? Because it was full of Jewish people. And so it was a direct provocation. If the police had wanted to say, no, you can't, because it would cause disorder and it's a provocation, they could have done. But instead they decided to, as it were, defend, or even more, to force a way through for Mosley to come through. In fact, because somewhere between 100,000 and 200,000 people turned out, nothing the police could do on that day could let Oswald Mosley through. It took another 3 or 4 years for people to find out that he really did mean that he was a fascist, he really did sympathise with Adolf Hitler, and he was interned during the war.
So growing up in this household, inevitably you became very politically motivated.
Yes, there was a lot of politics, a lot of talking about politics. So I was born in 1946, all this time I'm talking about with my parents, I talk about it as being in the myth. So there are two myths. One is the fact that it's in a place where we don't live, the East End, and it's a time before I'm born. So it was like just a place of story. And so my parents would talk about the foods and about their families. And this was completely mysterious to me, because my parents had basically kind of, how can I put it, shaved off most of their family. So I only ever saw my mother's parents and her brother, and I only ever saw my father's sister and his mother, and all the other relatives that they spoke of were either in America, elsewhere in London and the south of England, or sadly had died in the concentration camps because they had lived in Poland and France. So all that, it was a kind of mystery in the house while they were talking about these political things going on as I was growing up, the Tory government and then later the Labour government, all of which was sort of, the air was full of it. And my parents campaigning for equal pay and for comprehensive schools. So it was, yes, the air was thick with it.
And why was there this mystery there? Were they trying to protect you in some way? Or
I think it's two or three things going on. They wanted to leave some aspects of the Jewish community. They wanted to start a new life. And so some of it meant that they kind of rejected their relatives. In my father's case, the American side of the family, that's his father's side, who he never knew, that's because his mother and father had split and he didn't really want to have anything to do with his father, so he was saying, well, my father rejected me, so I'll reject him, you know, that usual thing that children do. But then as far as the camps are concerned and the relatives, I think there it was that in the post-war period, it was almost impossible to know. If you had relatives who had been in Poland or France or any of those other countries that were occupied, or indeed Germany itself, how would you know? There was no document trail. It was entirely secret. In that sense, the Holocaust was, and I'm saying this with huge inverted commas around it, successful, because part of genocide is to get rid of people, and the other half of it is so you can't find out about them. They have gone, they've disappeared. It's an act of disappearance. And to that extent, you could say they'd been successful as far as my French and Polish relatives were concerned. So my parents used to just shrug. I'd say, well, what happened to these French uncles? I don't know. My dad would say, they were there at the beginning of the war. They weren't there at the end. But what about these Polish ones? I don't know. I don't know where they are. It was almost like, I can hear myself as I'm saying it, it was almost slightly resentful that we were asking, because they didn't know. My American relatives, where I went to see them, there was more shame and guilt about it, because they had addresses, and they had communicated with them, but they hadn't been able to help them. And so in their case, I think there was shame and guilt.
Mm. Have you done a lot of investigation then? Have you sort of explored these various limbs of the family tree that were unknown to you?
I have. I've spent about the last 20 years nibbling away, trying to find this track, and it's been very, very difficult until there was a sudden breakthrough in the way that, you know, other people may recognise, which is that some letters turned up in an outer reach of the family in America. And these were letters from the French uncles, my dad's French uncles, written to America asking for help. And they were writing from an address that I found in France. It was in a town called Niort in southwestern France, where they had fled the incoming invasion of the German army, along with the whole of eastern France, actually. Millions of people fled. I now had an address, and from that, because people had been piecing together what happened to Jews in that part of France, I could then piece together what happened to them. They had escaped and had fled to Nice, because Nice was occupied by the Italians, who were protecting the Jews, in fact, protecting them from the Nazis, even though they were allies. And then I used a library in London, the Wiener Library, which told me which hotel they were hiding in. Basically, the Jews were kind of squatting in the hotels, waiting to be shipped out to North Africa, where Monty, you remember, had won the Battle of El Alamein. But they didn't do it in time. The Nazis moved in, and they were shipped to Auschwitz. But I found all that out by piecing it together over about 20 years.
Fascinating chap. Former Children Laureate Michael Rosen, my guest this afternoon, who is visiting Cambridgeshire on Monday, where he'll be launching Heffer's Bookshop's Giving Tree Appeal in the afternoon before his memoir launch event at the Cambridge Union in the evening for his new book, So They Call You Pisher. It talks about his communist Jewish upbringing alongside many amusing anecdotes, including a run-in with famous Cambridgeshire resident Clive James, as I discovered when I caught up with Michael yesterday afternoon. We welcome on to Lunchtime Live this afternoon here on BBC Radio Cambridgeshire, my guest this afternoon, Michael Rosen, who will be visiting Heffer's Bookshop in Cambridge, or rather at the Cambridge Union for a Heffer's Bookshop event, talking about his memoir, So They Call You Pisher. I've got the title right this time, Michael. I'm learning.
You have. Beautiful. Yes.
I can't comfortably repeat what Clive James once said to you at a student review audition, which is featured in your book.
Yes, in Cambridge even, on the steps of the Arts Theatre. Yes, I was in an Oxford and Cambridge theatre group, and so I turned up with the Oxford group, which included Nigel Williams, whose sons are making waves with wonderful dramas on TV, but indeed so is Nigel, it's a novelist. And we turned up and joined the Cambridge crowd, which included, Clive James, Pete Atkin, Julie Covington, Rob Buckman, all sorts of people. And quickly it became apparent that the Cambridge material for this kind of review, and we were doing Midsummer Night's Dream, was much better than ours. But Clive set me to work on these huge monologues. They were about, 8 or 9 minutes long, and indeed they were very, very funny. But I'm not actually brilliant at learning stuff off by heart. Anyway, so I kept stumbling and needing cues, and I think Clive thought I was taking the mick. And I really wasn't. It's just I wasn't very good at it, but he did. He thought that I was taking the mick. So as we were leaving the theatre on one occasion, he suddenly came for me and said, "I'll have you." And luckily, he was pulled off by Russell Davis, a famous Radio 2 fame, Radio 2's great jazz and musicals expert, and a guy called Jonathan James Moore, sadly deceased. And they grabbed hold of Clive and kept him from actually landing one on my chin. But I bear him no ill will whatsoever. It must have been terribly, terribly frustrating for him, because he was just at a point where he felt that he was on the brink of something very special. He had Julie Covington singing her incredible songs, mm-hmm. Pete Atkin writing his wonderful music, and Clive was writing the lyrics for the songs and writing these very clever sketches. And indeed, as we know, Clive went on to become incredibly famous. Julie, well, for one reason or another, decided not to carry on with her incredible career. Pete did go on with his. Rob Buckman, very, very sadly, also died of, I think, an autoimmune disease. But And we know that Clive, in this terrible situation he's in, is in kind of ironically going from strength to strength. So I wish him all the best, or as I could say in Yiddish, shakoyach. That means all strength to you.
Have you spoken to him since that incident?
Believe it or not, I passed him in the street, and I said, just when I came up for one of your Cambridge book festivals, and I passed him in the street, and I said, "Hi, Clive, all the best." And he walked past and he turned round and waved, but I don't think he had noticed that it was me. So that is my only encounter with Clive since that occasion, yes. But as I say, I really do wish him the best.
He's probably waving his fist at you.
I hope so, yes. I hope he's still angry with me, but I'm certainly not angry with him. It would prove that, you know, his spirit is alive and well, which would be great.
Michael, you're, of course, renowned for your wonderful, wonderful children's books. What's it like writing for adults? Do you find it harder?
It is in its own way, yes, because I tell you what's harder is that if you have a tendency to write leaving gaps, it's the only thing I can describe, where you write things and you don't spell it all out, and then you try and sort of write chapters like that, you find you've got an editor on your back who says, "Well, what's the point of that? What's the point of that?" And you go, "Well, I thought that was obvious." And he goes, "No, it's not." So you sort of, ironically, you kind of have to spell it out a bit more. It's quite hard to say. It's almost a stylistic thing. So if you've got a little story about the fact, I don't know, let's say, I know, my mum. So here's my mum, and there's a typhoid outbreak in South America. It's 1960, and there are these big government warnings. Don't eat the corned beef. The corned beef's infected with typhoid. Don't eat the corned beef. So my mum goes to the cupboard, and she opens it up, and there's a great stack of corned beef tins in there. And she takes the corned beef tin out, and she goes, "Ooh, better not open that till the typhoid outbreak's over." Now, I'm inclined to finish a story there on the word "over." It's a bit like a punchline. But if you're writing what's called continuous prose, you kind of have to say, you know, something about your mother being a bit mysterious, or never quite knowing whether she meant it or not. If you just end it in the middle of... It sounds a bit like it's the end of the sentence. You see, it kind of works when I just told it to you as an anecdote, but in a chapter, sometimes these things need a bit more than that. And I find that it didn't immediately strike me that I had to do that. So my editor, a wonderful bloke called Leo Holly, stood over me with a big stick going, "Finish it off! Finish it off!"
Do you? I mean, you're quite recognisable because you have quite a presence, you know, visually on television and the like. Do you get heckled on the street by parents? You're like, "Wait, going on a bear hunt?" That sort of thing.
Parents, two-year-olds, sometimes recognise me from their pushchairs, from their buggies. It's quite funny. I can walk along the road and you suddenly see a two-year-old fix me with their eyes and point. And then you can see the kind of grown-up thinking, "Well, don't be rude, darling," because the adult hasn't recognised me. So it's quite funny. So I get two-year-old recognition. And the other thing I get is teenagers. They come up to me with their phones and then they ask me to repeat one bit of one video that I've done on my YouTube channel. I have a YouTube channel. And then what's happened is that these teenagers have clipped bits of it and made memes and GIFs and all the rest of it. And one of them is me going, I'll give it to you now. Nice. And that's me eating... I don't know, potato when I was at home in one of my poems. But for some reason or other, this has tickled teenagers, believe it or not, all over the English-speaking world. And I get these kind of torrents of email traffic and everything else. And the kids stop me in the street going, "Just do it, just say, nice." And Americans think I'm saying noice, N-O-I-C-E, because of my London accent. Because after all, Americans say nice. So the way I say nice... they hear it as noice, N-O-I-C-E. So I've become the bloke who says noice. And it's on buses, trains, just happened to me just now on the way in. I have to do selfies wherever I go.
And how do you feel about that?
It's fine. It's not what I might have anticipated or expected at the age of 71, that I would be amusing 17-year-olds by simply saying... what originally was a four-letter word, but it's now been extended to a five-letter one. And it's just me saying, noise. So it's not what I might have predicted about myself. No.
It sort of dovetails into my next question about possibly how we're failing our children. if they can't spell nice or pronounce it correctly for a start. But I mean, I know you're quite fervent about, you know, your feelings about the way we're educating primary and, you know, lower secondary children particularly. But, you know, what are we doing right or what are we doing wrong, Michael, in our schools?
I think teachers are doing a lot. They're very keen to help the kids and to do as much as they can. They jump through all the hoops the government gives them. My main argument is that the nature of the testing narrows down what we understand by reading, writing, enjoyment, understanding, interpreting. So the books that the children read, they have to do what's called retrieval, inference, chronology and presentation. So retrieval is if I say to you, Billy has a blue hat, what colour was his hat? Blue. And inference is if I say, it was raining, why was he wearing a hat? And you're supposed to say, because it was raining. But if you say it's because he supports Chelsea, right, you're wrong. But in actual fact, that's an interpretation, because after all, you have two bits of information there. You have raining and the fact that the hat's blue. But the tests say only one answer is right. Now, teachers have to teach to this so that the kids can do well in their SATs and in their end-of-term testing and all the rest of it. So I'm for a much more open way of trying to encourage children to interpret the things they read right from the very beginning. So that means asking much more open-ended questions and discussing things so that you can allow for this much more important business of understanding, or it's a posher word, cognition, to take place. But also what's important is that you learn the power of interpretation. That's what we are as human beings. We are interpreters from the day we are born. Look at a newborn baby. You know, you can see them. They're scanning the mum's face, if the mum's the first person they see. You can see them. They're busy interpreting all the textures and tastes and seeing scenes that they can see. And this is our power that we have as human beings, is interpreting things so then we can take action. And if you take that away because of the narrow nature of the testing, then that bothers me. And then if you then say that the writing has to jump through the hoops that are laid down by what are supposedly real grammatical structures like embedded relative clauses or fronted adverbials, and you say, well, good writing has a fronted adverbial in it, I think you're completely missing the point. But this is what the government say. If you're writing at the, I quote, expected level, unquote, then you're writing using these characteristics. But good writing is like Shakespeare, it's like Chaucer, it's like when children write and they're expressing ideas and feelings attached to beings that we might recognise and care about. It might be monsters, it might be your mum or your dad, it might also be monsters, if you're old Dahl, they are. You know, to do that, then the structure, the immediate structure of the sentence may not be have to fulfill, may not have to just jump through a hoop. And the same goes for non-fiction. I'm not just totally talking about fiction here. You know, you could be going and seeing the lions outside Fitzwilliam Museum, and you find out who built them, who made them, who sculpted them, you know, and you write that up. It doesn't mean that you have to put it into the structure. It doesn't have to have an embedded relative clause to make it good. It doesn't have to have a fronted adverbial. It doesn't have to have an expanded noun phrase. These are all the phrases that they, all the stuff that they throw at these kids in year 5 and 6. And if they don't get a good mark. And the teacher himself or herself is marked down. You know, they're failing because they're not doing it. You know, I remember going to an open evening with one of my children, and the teacher said, "Oh, we're very pleased with his writing because he's embedding his relative clauses." And I thought, well, actually, you know, I'm not really bothered whether he is or he isn't. I'd be much more interested to know from you whether, you know, he can write up that fantastic trip that you had to the Isle of Wight, and whether he can say about how exciting it was to go and see the dinosaurs, rather than whether actually he said a sentence, "The dinosaur, which was on the Isle of Wight, was really interesting." I don't need the "which was on the Isle of Wight" bit. I don't need that, you know, as a parent or as an educator. You know, just tell me what moved you, excited you, and what was interesting, and what facts excited you.
Michael, it's been an absolute... Well, I was going to say it's been an absolute delight, but I think I'd best describe our conversation as being nice.
Exactly. Brilliant. Yeah, nice.
Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Children's author Michael Rosen, my guest this afternoon here on BBC Radio Cambridgeshire, and you can be his guest at Heffer's Bookshop Monday afternoon when he launches their Giving Tree appeal, or at his memoir launch at the Cambridge Union. That's in the evening on Monday. Tickets £10 in advance, £12 on the door, and can be purchased through Eventbrite by calling 01223 46 3200 or in person at Heffer's Bookshop in Cambridge.